up in old movies sometimes. Some rich, glamorous character mentions not staying in some grand hotel, but actually living there, more or less permanently. Back in the days when any well-heeled person was expected to have servants to do the dirty work around the house, moving into a hotel essentially outsourced the problem of finding and keeping good help. But it wasn't just Eloise at the Plaza and Tennessee Williams at the Elysee. In previous generations, lots of people at lots of income levels lived in hotels for extended periods of time. Could hotels be a solution to the problem of affordable housing now? From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. It might sound like a weird idea until you think about all the people priced out of buying homes or even renting apartments in some parts of the country where demand is still outpacing supply. Henry Grabar is a staff writer at Slate and considers the possibilities of using hotels as housing in his article, The Hotel Spirit. Henry, welcome to Think.
Thanks for having me.
There are shortages in many areas of the housing sector for a lot of reasons. You write here about ski slopes in Aspen. So tons of people understandably want to work there. A lot of them end up quitting before they start, though, right? Because they can't find a place to live.
Yeah. The head of the Aspen Skiing Company, which runs the mountain resort, has talked about how they have a worker shortage, but it's not really a worker shortage in the sense that nobody wants to work there. The problem is that they cannot find anywhere for these people to live. And I think this is a problem actually across the Mountain West. There's a story about Sun Valley in the New York Times today that describes people living in tents, in garages. And these are people who have jobs, right? But that's how hard up these places are for housing. And it's become a real chronic issue, especially, I think, with the rise of remote work in the last couple of years.
Okay, so people who, because of the pandemic, are now allowed to work from home, they can really work from anywhere, so they go to these more romantic locations and use up housing that workers might have rented before?
Yeah, I mean, part of it is something that's been going on for a while with Airbnb, but I think that people's ability to, a certain class of white collar workers' ability to work from basically anywhere has helped exacerbate a crisis that has already been ongoing in these places and is now reaching crisis proportions. And, you know, we should say also, this is not just about remote workers. This is also about, I think, California exporting its housing crisis to places like Idaho, Montana, Colorado. But yeah, housing in these places has become super, super expensive, and so expensive that the people who work in places like the Aspen Ski Resort are running out of options.
When you say California is outsourcing its housing problem, you mean people who are priced out of the market in California go live in these other spots?
Right. That's been the big trend over the last few years. And California has some of the most, in fact, the most expensive housing in the nation relative to income in many of its coastal cities. So I'm talking about places like San Diego, Los Angeles, San Francisco, which of course has one of the highest cost of living in the nation. And those people are moving to cities like Boise and Boulder and driving up the cost of living there.
How did the Aspen ski area solve its housing problem?
Well, they rented a hotel, funny enough. And it's one of these situations where it's almost like a reversal of how things should work, where you had all these remote workers coming to Aspen and living there for, you know, weeks or months at a time and sort of living it up. And they were moving into the city's long-term housing stock, while the people who actually worked there wound up getting put in a hotel about 60 miles away, an hour's drive away. And driving in every morning and driving out every night. But that was the best solution that the company could come up with for where to house these people.
How much vacancy does the U.S. hotel industry have at any given time these days?
Quite a lot. Occupancy rates have jumped back over 50%. I want to say it's something like 55 or so. So they have, to a large extent, recovered from the trough of the pandemic. But some types of travel have not come back, right? Like business travel, for example, is not what it once was. There is one bright spot for the hotel industry in all of this, which is the extended stay hotel. That has been basically consistently above 70% occupancy throughout this time. So that shows that there is a real desire for people to have these flexible medium-term housing arrangements that hotels provide.
We don't really think of hotels as a housing option these days. Of course, for a long time, there were people who moved in and stayed. I had always assumed, until I read your article, that people who talked about living in hotels actually like rented apartments that had been built on the top of hotel buildings. That's not necessarily the case.
No, often they partook in regular hotel services. They didn't have kitchens. They had someone come and make the bed every day. Obviously, this depends enormously on the class of hotel you're talking about. But for people who are at the top end of the chain, I think that was part of the appeal of hotel living. As you said in your introduction, they outsourced the so many of their domestic responsibilities, and that was something that was not only appealing for the super rich, but even for, say, a young couple, for example. A woman might be liberated from her traditional domestic responsibilities of, say, furnishing the place, cooking, all that stuff, which would have been expected in the 1940s and 50s. Suddenly that just wasn't your responsibility anymore in a hotel. And so people actually lived in hotel rooms up and down the income ladder, but often in hotels that specialized in that sort of residential stay. I mean, these were places where you could stay by the night, but many, many patrons stayed by the week or the month.
And part of that was that it used to take a lot longer to get to places you might travel to, right? So it made sense if you'd spent a week getting from one coast to the other, you weren't just going to stay three nights.
Right. This was a huge thing in vacation communities, for example, right? So late 19th century, early 20th century, every resort town in America, whether it's, like take Atlantic City, for example. I mean, that was a place that wasn't even that far from some major population centers, but still would have been someplace that people would go for weeks at a time. And that meant that, not only were you staying in the hotel, you'd stay in the hotel for weeks at a time, and this would become a kind of social scene. I mean, it provided for not just for kids, but also for grownups, a sense of community in these vacation destinations. And that was one of the things that made long vacations possible and appealing in those days, was having someplace where you could set your things down and feel at home.
There was a plot line a couple seasons ago in Marvelous Mrs. Maisel, and they would go back to the same resort at the Catskills every summer, and it just seemed so idyllic.
I got that sense too. In fact, one of the things that inspired me to read this was E.L. Doctorow's, to write this piece, was reading E.L. Doctorow's novel Ragtime, which also features an idyllic long hotel stay at some summer beachside resort. And it got me thinking, why don't we have that anymore? All I read are headlines in newspapers and TV segments about how all these resort towns, I mean, places like Aspen, cannot find enough housing for their workers, in part because all the vacationers are renting up the housing stock through Airbnb or other rental platforms. And I thought, why aren't people staying in these types of institutions anymore? What happened to them?
Yeah, when was the era that you refer to as the golden age of hotel dwelling?
I would put it from the end of the Civil War until the 1950s. Back in the late 19th century, there's a book called Hotel Dreams by a historian named Molly Berger. And she writes about these big 19th century hotels as being, in many cases, the pride and joy of the cities they were built in. I mean, we're talking like the what would have been the equivalent in an American city of a great cathedral in a European city, which is to say, the largest and fanciest building in town, the one to which locals would show, the one that locals would show to visiting relatives to establish how serious their city was, what its place in the world was. That's the kind of establishment that begins to take hold in American city centers in the late 19th century. Those places are not just places for visitors to stay. They're also often places where new technology gets tried out first. Stuff like laundries, pneumatic mail, elevators, indoor plumbing. A lot of these developments came first to grand hotels because they were some of the, you know, fanciest establishments in town, and they could afford and were interested in making those kind of investments long before they would have arrived at regular people's apartments. You know, something like electric light, even. And, you know, that would have been at that time, obviously, a big incentive to go and take a room in a hotel for a long period of time.
But middle-sized and small cities are no longer building these grand hotels. What happened to the demand for them?
Well, I think, you know, the big moment of change for the residential hotel happens in the 1950s and 60s. In the 1950s, you have basically an incredible abundance of rooming houses, lodging houses, hotels of all stripes that are just in every American downtown and in many, many American residential neighborhoods. And they provide a source of housing for young people, old people, rich people, poor people, everybody in between. I mean, it is just a, such a central part of the housing landscape. And those begin to disappear in the 1960s. And I think part of the reason they disappeared was because we didn't really need them anymore. People didn't go and stay someplace. They didn't stay in one place on vacation for 2 months anymore because they had cars and they had planes and go wherever they wanted. People had more demanding jobs. Women entered the workforce. And so, again, another strike against that sort of long vacation idea. But the more, I think, for the purposes of big cities, the more substantive changes were the, you know, federally subsidized suburbanization. So home ownership becomes more attainable than ever before. So to a large extent, people didn't need, even young people, didn't need that stepping stone anymore before they coupled up and were able to, you know, buy a house at age 22, 23, 24, which seems inconceivable today, but that was totally mainstream in the 1950s. And that's one of the things that did away with the model.
And early on, also, there were concerns, right, about the moral hazards of single people, especially single women living in hotels.
Right. Yeah. So that's the other half of this story, is that in addition to demand falling for hotels, there's also this concerted effort to get rid of them. Now, this begins with sort of moral reformers in the early 20th century. The kinds of people who would have complained about slum housing conditions were also very concerned about hotels because they felt that hotels bred ill morals and they were places of prostitution and loose living and too much drinking and socializing. And all of those things were probably true, but they were also an essential source of flexible and affordable housing. And in the 1950s, as suburbanization takes off, you see a kind of hotels begin to downscale a little bit. They move down the status ladder, and places that would once have been associated with regular working people begin to be associated more with seedy types.
So, Henry, you were saying in the middle part of the 20th century, another problem with people living in hotels or something like them was that single men without a lot of money ended up in these kind of hotel adjacent spaces called SROs, single room occupancy buildings. First of all, what was the setup at these places?
Yeah, so basically you have this big hotel boom turning into a bust. And that means people who owned hotels began to go more and more down market, catered to a lower and lower income type of tenant. And the result of this was the rise of the single room occupancy hotel. Now, that's not so different from what a hotel had been earlier in the 20th century, but it begins to describe a particular type of hotel that has certain shared amenities, especially bathrooms. So these would be absolutely the most basic accommodations where you would pay for a room, but you certainly would not have any sort of kitchen or anything like that. And you would often share a bathroom down the hall with as many as 10 other rooms. And so this was nobody's ideal, right? But it was a source, an essential source, as it turned out, of affordable housing for people who were down on their luck and had nowhere else to go. These places were city planners did everything they could to eradicate them, and they were largely successful. The statistics are pretty astounding. I mean, we're talking like tens of thousands of SRO units eliminated during the urban renewal period and in the decades afterwards, 1970s and 80s. And the result was that basically as a housing typology, it all but disappeared from the American city.
But the people who needed to live there didn't disappear.
No, they didn't. They often wound up homeless. I think there's a consensus now that the modern homelessness crisis, while it has many causes, but it could not have happened without the elimination of the SRO. I mean, cities did everything they could to get rid of this housing type, and they succeeded. And I think that homelessness today, it has to be understood in the context of us getting rid of this basically low-end type of housing. And I understand nobody liked the SRO. People didn't like living there. People didn't like living near them. Many housing reformers rightly felt that they were not sufficiently sanitary or safe to be a type of housing that we tolerated in the richest nation in the world. And yet, by eliminating them and not replacing them with anything, we wound up creating a massive homelessness problem for people who couldn't afford their own apartments.
One of the things cities did to force these things to close down was they just changed building codes, right? What did they make different that made it much harder to operate an SRO?
Well, it's not very hard, right? I mean, the conditions for SROs are so particular. So, for example, many cities require apartments have their own bathrooms. That's an easy one. Suddenly, boom, SROs are illegal. In many cases, the institutions were grandfathered in, right? So they weren't eliminated by the code, but they slowly began to disappear and they were never replaced because nobody ever built a new SRO, at least not without federal funding, which wasn't accessible for this housing type until quite late in the 20th century. The other thing they did was they established parking requirements. So if you say that every unit needs to have one or two parking spaces that goes with it, suddenly that renders a building a super low cost housing totally infeasible. It doesn't pencil out at all. So those are some examples of the code changes cities made to get rid of these institutions.
And parking requirements are all well and good if you're catering to middle class or even working class people, but lots of lower income folks don't have a vehicle to begin with.
Yeah, in a lot of cases, the parking requirements were explicitly designed to get rid of SROs. For example, in San Diego in the 1990s, there began to be a small SRO revival because people realized that San Diego's homelessness problem was directly related to the loss of these long-term residential hotels for people who could not afford apartments in an increasingly expensive city. And so people in San Diego, housing reformers, affordable housing advocates, started building SROs again after 30 years of decline. And people got upset because they didn't like living near SROs. And so they established a parking requirement. Suddenly, no more SROs. Voila, problem solved.
I mean, we talk so much in this country about the importance of neighborhoods that accommodate people of different income levels. What are the primary objections to the sort of permanent residents who might live close to something like an SRO?
You mean the objections of residents who do not want SROs near them?
Why do they not want them there?
Well, I think there's a long tradition in this country of trying to protect people's their nest egg, right? Their the value of their home from any possible intrusion. And I'm taking them in the most good faith possible reading of the opposition here. It's that people are worried about not just SROs, but apartment buildings generally, and the types of people who are associated with them, that they bring crime, and derelicts and danger to the neighborhood and all that. So that's the mainstream of opposition. If I were being less charitable, I would say simply that people do not like to live near poor people, and that's one of the reasons that nobody wants to live near an SRO.
Some people worry that hotel residents might have maybe formed communities with their neighbors in the building but didn't integrate into the broader communities around them. Was this a valid concern?
You know, I don't know. I think to some extent, people who lived in SROs were pretty integrated in the communities they lived in because they had such minimal resources at their place of residence, right? So if you don't have a kitchen, you have to eat all your meals outside, more or less. And so, you know, if you go back to the 1950s, these neighborhoods that were full of hotels, both SROs and maybe something closer to rooming houses, maybe with a, you know, a sort of resident who owned a house and rented out the rooms to lodgers and that sort of thing. Those neighborhoods often also came with low-cost cafes and laundromats and all these sort of institutions that catered to people who had to get out of their rooms during the day because they were small and didn't have all those services. So I think people who lived in these places were also often quite integrated in their communities.
All right, I want to go to the phones. Our number is 1-800-933-5372. Ben is calling from North Dallas. Hi, Ben.
Hi, Chris. Thanks for taking my call. Yeah, I wanted to bring to your attention, you may both know about this, in the same tradition as the long summer vacations you mentioned in the Mrs. Maisel movie and Dirty Dancing, if you remember that, sea cruising has almost all the components of those type of longer vacations. You know, the afternoon tea, playing games, laying out by the pool, getting to know people, and communal dinner with people, having your drink at the bar with the same people every night. Although, because of the working requirements of 21st century, we do it 1 week at a time, but there are people, retired people, that do longer cruises or do back-to-backs or cross the Atlantic back and forth. And like my wife and I are cruisers, and we've got to, although we're not retired yet, but we've met people on cruises that we go on more cruises with. And the only difference is that it's on a ship, and it's only 1 week or 2 weeks at a time.
Well, Ben, thank you so much for your call. What do you know about that, Henry? I've heard, too, about retired folks deciding it's easier and less expensive than a lot of assisted living centers.
That is so interesting. I had not thought about that comparison at all. But it makes a lot of sense because one of the institutions that challenged the long stay hotel was the rise of the corporate retirement home, right? Like that has become the facility in which older people are expected to end up in. But for most of the 20th century, that was not the case. And in the 1940s and 50s, certainly hotels functioned as a sort of naturally occurring source of housing for the elderly. In fact, we could go so far as to say that hotels provided a place for anyone who didn't really fit into the traditional nuclear family typology. And that is something that continues to be a problem with the American housing stock, is that unless you, have a family that's perfectly sized for basically a, you know, single family suburban home, it can be often hard to find someplace that fits. And that's not just for poor people. That's for older people, too, who find themselves, you know, years, maybe one or two people stuck in a house that was built for seven.
So the upshot was that many thousands of these SRO housing units vanished from the marketplace. Residential hotels were not so much a thing anymore. Some of these folks might, in fact, have ended up on the street, but otherwise, then they're competing with everybody else for an ever more limited supply of housing per capita.
Yeah, and right. So I think that this is a problem that, again, is not just limited to the poorest of the poor. Anyone who has tried to find a place in an American city knows there are very few accommodations for single adults. It's just not a type of housing that we have in enormous supply. And as a result, a lot of young people moved to cities in the 1940s. They would have maybe taken a room at a boarding house until they met somebody and got married and bought a house or something like that. But these days, the standard practice is to find an apartment, a 3 or 4 bedroom apartment, and share it with a bunch of other 20 somethings. And that both requires some, I would say, unnecessary and not ideal situations. So, you know, sharing your living space with people, buying a bunch of cheap furniture, arguing about the dishes, all these sorts of things. But it also takes apartments out of the long-term housing stock, just like Airbnb does. And so you end up with family-sized apartments getting let out to kids in their 20s.
Okay, let's go back to the phones. We have Chris on the line in McKinney. Hi, Chris.
Hey, Chris. Different spelling, same name. Hey, I think your guest might be a little out of touch, or there's a,
overgeneralization there to think, well, people want to protect their property values. That's why people don't want SROs or boarding homes or, I mean, those are essentially fancy words for homeless shelters near where they saved up money to buy a home. It's been proven time and time again that one of the greatest catalysts for crime is income inequality within close geographical proximity for one another. So that's why when you get into the inner city, when you get into cities, at least in Dallas, just north of Dallas, cities like University Park or Highlands Park, very close, you have million-dollar homes and utter poverty, and that's why there's significant crime. So I don't think it's fair to say it's the evil white folks that want to protect their home from the poorer folks moving nearby them. I think it's crime, and it's been proven time and time again with empirical and objective evidence that that's the case. And I thought it was a pretty broad overgeneralization to think, well, people want to protect the value of their homes.
Oh, Chris, I really appreciate your call. I don't remember Henry talking about evil white people, but Henry, maybe you want to clarify or respond to that.
Oh, I don't really dispute that people are concerned about crime or say they are. I think that's a valid concern. I think we should weigh it against the result, the results of the policy that we've undertaken, right? Which is a total absence of low-income housing in most American neighborhoods. And the consequences of that have been really, really severe, not just economic segregation between neighborhoods, but at the level of homeless shelters, people's refusal to live near homeless shelters, the result of that is people living on the street. And so at a certain point, you have to say, okay, I'm concerned about crime, but am I not more concerned that there's a family living under an underpass here, under a highway, like in the richest country in the world? Is that the best we can do?
How different, I mean, I don't know that you have data on this, but I wonder about the difference between a population that is living in a designated homeless shelter as compared with folks who are working and paying a very modest rent, but paying for their own housing in some kind of alternative situation in terms of crime levels and that kind of thing.
I really can't speak to the correlation between SROs and crime, but I can tell you that in high-cost cities, the people who are now becoming homeless are not people who don't have jobs. They are often people who do have jobs, sometimes two-earner households with kids. I think New York City has something like 100,000 homeless children, and that might mean that those children are living with relatives or something like that. It doesn't necessarily mean that they're living on the street or in a homeless shelter. But it just speaks to the fact that the housing crisis in these places has gotten so severe that even people who are working one or two jobs cannot afford the rent. So I think what we're talking about here is not just a solution for older single men, you know, with a drinking problem, which is to say your stereotypical homeless guy, right? Like the problem in America has become much, much broader in terms of the types of people who are affected by the lack of affordable housing.
There are now some cities looking to use converted hotels and motels to provide safe and stable places to live for folks who are unhoused. How is that going down in cities around the country?
Well, New York has been doing this for years because New York City has an obligation as a result of a court decree to provide housing to provide shelter to anybody who wants it. And so that means that New York has a lot of homeless shelters where homeless people live, but it also means that for homeless families, they've often found that renting hotel rooms is the easiest way to get those people with a roof over their head, a little privacy, et cetera. So in a way they're sort of coming back around to this mid-century logic of, oh, well, actually it's good to have a type of housing that falls somewhere in between, you know, a dormitory or a shelter and a fully furnished apartment with a kitchen and whatever. You know, it's good to have something in the middle, and New York is making use of that. That doesn't mean there's not opposition to it. There's tremendous, tremendous opposition to it in New York. California has done something similar, another state that really suffers from high housing costs. And they've started to rent out hotels. They started this during COVID for people who they thought would be vulnerable to COVID. But the result has been mostly homeless people living in hotels.
The project in California that you were referring to, Henry, I think, is this Project Room Key in California?
That's right, yes.
And are the folks administering this program buying up these hotels and motels, or are they just buying rooms at various for-profit organizations?
The system that they put in place during the pandemic, when nobody was staying in hotels, was that the jurisdictions would rent out the hotels using state funds and then give out the rooms to people in their jurisdictions who needed rooms. And one of the things we've learned about homelessness is that homelessness is it's correlated with high housing costs. It's not correlated with poverty, with drug use, with mental health problems, anything like that. And the number one thing that you need to do to help homeless people get back on their feet is give them a roof over their head, because a lot of the problems that we associate with homelessness, such as disorder crimes like public urination, drug use, that sort of thing, are often the result of being unhoused, right? And the sort of stresses that come with living on the street. So I think one of the things they've noticed with Project Room Key is that if you can get people with their own room and a roof over their head and a place to sleep where they feel safe, where they can not worry about their belongings being stolen, their quality of life starts to improve dramatically. And you can see it not just as a permanent solution to the housing crisis, but as maybe a first step on the housing ladder to helping these people get their footing in society again.
You discovered in your reporting that some families are using extended stay hotels to keep a roof over their heads as they try to ride out the prices, of the housing market and losing out on houses they bid on and apartments. I mean, doing the math in my head, honestly, it seems untenable, because even like, you know, at $99 a night, the cost for a month-long hotel stay maybe, you know, as much as a mortgage. But in some parts of the country, maybe this evens out?
Well, I'm not sure it ever evens out. I don't think it's anybody's first choice, right? It's a solution of last resort for people who find themselves losing their housing. You get evicted, you need a place and you need a quick fix, right? And this is a place where, you know, a motel by the side of the highway might be available, not only at a price you can afford, but a lot of these places will offer weekly or monthly room rates. So it ends up being cheaper than the sticker price that you or I would calculate, you know, looking at the billboard on the side of the road. The benefit of this is obviously that it keeps people out of homelessness. The drawback is that a lot of these places are pretty isolated. I mean, these are not located in nice residential neighborhoods. It often means taking your kids out of the school district or far from the school where they would have been enrolled. And of course, it also means often living in a place with a lot of traffic noise where you can't necessarily walk to get something to eat or to a park.
Yeah. Why does it happen that these places are so often just along the side of a freeway somewhere? Is that about trying to pick up traffic in from out of town?
That's for sure part of it. There's definitely an element of attractiveness if you run a certain type of motel of locating along the highway. But the other thing that happened as part of this mid-century drive to get rid of the residential hotel was there were a lot of zoning restrictions put in place about where hotels could operate. And that means that basically in an American city today, there are two places for hotels. There's the downtown, which tends to have a kind of upmarket business clientele. And then there's the sort of area along highway interchanges, which tends to be more low rent. And there's basically nothing in between. And this is one of the ways that I see the rise of Airbnb is sort of catering to that arbitrage where hotels just are not serving that market of people who want to live in regular residential neighborhoods. And Airbnb pops in and says, oh, we'll do that. And they open up a whole new swath of the city. And I don't think it's that people necessarily want to live in other people's houses or apartments. It's just that Airbnb is offering them locations that they can't find with hotels.
Right. And again, if you don't have a car, that hotel or motel by the side of the freeway may essentially leave you marooned there because public transit may not go by there, that sort of thing.
Yeah, it's really not a great option for a number of reasons. And I don't think it's anybody's first choice. But I do think that it helps us recognize that hotels are part of the housing ecosystem. They are not a separate commercial establishment. They're definitely entwined, especially there at the bottom level with housing. And to some extent, you know, we should see the provision of extended stay hotels as an important service, really, that provides a sort of flexible accommodation for people who need it, and not just people who may have just lost their housing, but also traveling workers, people like traveling nurses or contractors who come to a town and need a place to stay for weeks or months at a time. Extended stay hotels do that, cater to that market as well.
Are hotel and motel chains picking up on the rising demand for extended stay?
To some extent, yes. I mean, there's, you know, one of the reasons I think that I was not conscious of the extended stay hotel as a concept was because all these hotel brands have started their own, you know, sort of different, what's the word, like sub brand,
right,
that caters to these people. So like Residence Inn by Marriott would be a sort of upscale example of this, right? And so at your regular Marriott, you're not going to see rates being advertised to stay somewhere by the week or by the month, because those would be at the Residence Inn. So yes, the hotel industry is desperate to compete with Airbnb. It's just that I don't think they've quite hacked it yet.
But this can be profitable, right? I mean, the costs of getting somebody in and having them stay 2 weeks, 3 weeks, a month has to be less for the hotel than cleaning that room top to bottom every single day to turn the room over nightly.
Oh, definitely. It's attractive. It's, you know, it's a different business model and one they're not accustomed to. But I think people are recognizing that it's a pretty good business model, especially with the worker shortage that we're seeing right now. You know, it's a model that's attractive, and there have been a number of huge investments in this space, and billions of dollars pouring in. It's the fastest growing type of hotel, and also I should say that speaks to a demand, right? I mean, there's all these things. It's people on, you know, trying to find their way onto the housing ladder. It's traveling workers. It's remote workers. It's people on vacation. It's people trying out a new place. I mean, you see this in the Airbnb data too. Stays of a month or longer are Airbnb's largest, fastest growing category, and they now make up 1/4 of all Airbnb bookings. So it's pretty significant.
All right, let's go back to the phones. We have Jean calling from Dallas. Hi, Jean.
Hi. This show reminded me that I lived in a residence hotel, billed as a residence hotel for young Protestant businesswomen in the West Village in New York. And there were no men above the first floor, allowed above the first floor. The doors were locked at 10:30. That's why they said businesswomen, because there were nurses were not, if they worked a night shift, you know, were not encouraged. And there were two meals a day, you know, and hotel services for rooms, common bathroom. My sister lived in the Martha Washington while she studied fashion design, which was similar.
And how was that experience for you and your sister, Jean?
It was a very nice, for me, it was great. It was the West Village. It was really a nice street that I couldn't afford to live on. Mm. And, but the doors were locked at 10:30. And, you know, so there was a sense that you were pretty safe in the place. The second floor was a writing and music area. You know, it was pretty civilized.
Thanks so much for calling in. Henry, your piece reminds us that there are people experimenting with, Jean describes something that's almost like a women's dormitory, but was, you know, for adult women. There are things like this happening, urban co-living spaces, right?
Yeah, it's funny. That's such a great story. It's so nice to hear from somebody who actually lived this this scene, which is now so hard to find in American cities. Right. So you've got people that I think have recognized that there is this desire, and always has been, on the part of young adults to, you know, get out of their family's houses and get a place of their own. And right now those people are stuck. I mean, the percentage of 20 somethings living with their parents is something like 50%. I mean, it's reached levels we haven't seen since the Great Depression. And so the question is there a model that can provide those people with relatively affordable housing in the city, even if it means making some sacrifices? And yes, there are these co-living startups that are trying to do that by basically saying, all right, well, you'll have a room, but maybe you'll share a kitchen. Maybe you'll share a bathroom, something like that. Maybe you'll share some common amenities. And I think that's really attractive. The problem is that so far, it's basically been targeted at a pretty upmarket crowd. So I would look forward to them. You know, I think to some extent that's the way all business models start, and it takes a while for those sources, institutions to filter down and become more affordable. So the more co-living facilities we get now, the more affordable single room hotels we'll have in 20 years.
The other thing about an arrangement like that, Henry, or like some kind of, you know, decent longer term occupancy hotel is, you know, I have four kids in their early 20s, and it's expensive to get all the stuff you need. particularly if you happen to want to live without a roommate. You got to buy a bed, you got to buy a couch, you got to buy a kitchen table, on top of paying what might be a significant rent.
Yeah, it's not a great model. I think that the scene among 20-somethings in cities is full of people buying basically like cheap kind of junky stuff and then either throwing it away or trying to, you know, sell it to somebody for 10 or 15 bucks because this stuff has no resale value. I mean, it doesn't stick around. So it takes up money and it's sort of wasteful. And the other thing is, I think it inhibits people from being super mobile, right? Because every time you move someplace, it requires this big commitment of buying all this stuff. And I'm not just talking like furniture, but also like sheets and towels, dishes. Even just finding a place is a hassle, right? Because you've got to sometimes find roommates on Craigslist, you got to audition, you got to figure out if you like these people or not. And all those situations, that was once a place where these places, the type that the last caller was talking about, that filled that niche. That was the first place you went as a young person when you arrived in a city.
What do you think would have to happen to convince more people to be open to the possibility of these kinds of hotels opening in or around their neighborhoods?
Gosh, that is the million-dollar question. I think a lot, you know, I hope that nobody reads this piece and thinks, oh, you want people to stay in hotels? Like, what about housing? Believe me, I would love there to be more affordable housing in this country too. Unfortunately, with both housing and hotels, we see the same problem, which is that nobody wants them in their neighborhood. And maybe some people, like the earlier caller, are worried about crime. Maybe some people are worried about the property values. Many people just don't seem to like change at all. They seem to just want things to stay exactly as they always have been. And that's part of the motivation to oppose these things as well. So when it comes to convincing people, I think, you know, it helps to recognize that these kinds of institutions are not necessarily targeted at people who are, you know, super down on their luck coming off the streets. I mean, that's part of the reason to support more housing diversity. But it's also for young people who are trying to leave the house. It's for old people who are trying to downsize. It's for people who find themselves, you know, right after a divorce or something like that. I mean, right, you know, fresh to a new city. There's all these kinds of marginal situations between the sort of more stable periods of life where people need this kind of variable accommodation. And I think when you make the argument, this is for people like us. It's for everyone. It's just maybe you're not at the point of your life where you need it, but maybe you will be one day.
Is there any danger that by the time we scale up the availability of housing units like these to meet the demands of the current moment, that moment will have passed?
I think that would be great if that's the case. if we build enough housing units that they're no longer in demand and they start to get a little cheaper, I think that would be the best possible thing that could happen.
And of course, there appears to be no diminishment in the need for housing as we speak. So we'd have to build a whole lot before that became a thing.
Yeah, that's the issue, right? I mean, as a country, we are so short on housing units. We've got people living in their cars. We've got people living in garages. We've got people living in tents, people doubling up, people living with their parents until they're 35. It's a real crisis. And so I don't really see us being very close to overbuilding anytime soon. I think, you know, in the 2010s, we built less housing as a country than in any decade since the 1930s. So we're behind. We're behind by several million housing units, and it's going to take a lot of work for us to get back even.
Henry Grabar is a staff writer at Slate, where you can read his article, The Hotel Spirit. Henry, it's been really interesting. Thanks for making time for us.
My pleasure.
You can like our page on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, or subscribe to our podcast. It's free wherever you get your podcast. Just search for KERA Think and sign up. Again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.